Chapter 29. The Last Knot. Perrin stood just below the ridgetop, near the edge of the fog, and studied the encampment and stone-walled town below. 200 paces of fairly steep slope, sparsely dotted with low brush down to level ground, perhaps 700 more of cleared ground to the first tents, then better than a mile to the town. It seemed so close now. He did not use his looking-glass. A glint off a lens from the sun just peeking over the horizon, a fingernail edge of golden red, might ruin everything. The grayness around him curled, but did not really move with the breeze, even when it gusted and made his cloak stir. The dense mist on the far ridge, obscuring the windmill there, seemed too still as well, if you studied it a while. How long before someone among those tents noticed? There was nothing to be done for it. The fog felt like any fog, damp and a little cool, but somehow Niald had fixed these mists in place before he went off to his other tasks. The sun would not burn them off even at noonday, or so the Ashaman claimed. Everything would be done by noon, one way or another, but Perrin hoped the man was right. The sky was clear, and the day looked to be warm for early spring. Only a few Shido seemed to be outside in the camp, relatively speaking, but thousands of white-clad figures bustled about among the tents. Tens of thousands. His eyes ached to find Fail among them, his heart ached to see her. But he could as well try to pick out one particular pin from a barley basket of them spilled on the ground. Instead, he stared at the town's gates, standing wide open as they had every time he had gazed on them. Invitingly wide. They called to him. Soon, Fail and her companions would know it was time to head for those gates, and the towered fortress that bulked at the north end of the town. She might be at chores if the maidens were right about how the prisoners would be treated as Gaishine, but she would know to slip away and go to the fortress. She and her friends, and likely Alice as well. Whatever her scheme with the Shido, the Aes Sedai would not want to remain on a battleground. A second sister in the fortress might come in handy. The Light's End, it did not come to that. He had planned with care for every eventuality he could imagine down to outright disaster, yet this was no blacksmith's puzzle, however much he wished it were. The twisted iron pieces of a blacksmith's puzzle moved only in certain ways. Move them in the right way, and the puzzle came apart. People could move in a thousand ways, sometimes in directions you never believed possible till it happened. Would his plans stand up when the Shido did something unexpected? They would do it, almost certainly, and all he could do in return was hope it would not lead to that disaster. With a last longing look at Malden's gates, he turned and walked back up the ridge. Inside the fog, even he could not see 10 paces, but he soon found Danil Lewin among the trees on the ridgetop. Lean to the point of skinny, with a pickaxe for a nose and thick mustaches in the Terrabonner style, Danil stood out even when you could not see his face clearly. Other Two Rivers men were shapes beyond him, growing dimmer and dimmer with distance. Most were squatting or sitting on the ground, resting while they had the chance. Jory Conger was trying to entice some of the others into a game of dice, but he was quiet about it, so Perrin let it pass. No one was accepting the offer anyway. Jory was uncommon lucky with his dice. Danil made a leg when he saw Perrin and murmured, "My lord." The man had been spending too much time with Fael's people. He called it acquiring polish, whatever that was supposed to mean. A man was not a piece of brass. "Make sure nobody does anything woolhead foolish like I just did, Danil. Sharp eyes below might spot movement near the edge of the fog and send men to investigate." Danil coughed discreetly into his hand. Light he was getting as bad as any of those Kyrianen and Tyrans. "As you say, my lord, I'll keep everybody back." "My lord," Balwar's dry voice said out of the mist. "Ah, there you are, my lord." The little stick of a man appeared, followed by two larger shapes, though one was not much taller. They halted at a gesture from him, indistinct forms in the fog, and he came on alone.
"Massima has put in an appearance below, my lord," he said quietly, folding his hands. "I thought it best to keep Javier and Nerion out of his sight and his men's, under the circumstances. I don't believe he is suspicious of them. I think he has anyone he is suspicious of killed. But out of sight, out of mind is best.
Perrin's jaw tightened. Massima was supposed to be beyond the eastern ridge with his army, if it could be called that. He had counted those men, and a few women, as they shuffled uneasily through gateways made by the Tuashimon, and they were 20,000 if they were one. Massima had always been vague about their numbers, and Perrin had not had an accurate count until last night. Ragged and dirty, only one here or there wore a helmet, much less a breastplate, but every hand had gripped sword or spear or axe, halberd or crossbow, the women included. The women among Massima's followers were worse than the men by far, and that was saying something. For the most part, the lot of them were only good for terrorizing people into swearing to follow the Dragon Reborn. The colors whirled in his head and were scattered by his anger, that and murdering them if they refused. They had a better purpose today. "Maybe it's time for Javier and Narion to start staying away from Massima's people for good," he said.
"If you wish it, my lord, but in my judgment they still are as safe as any man can be doing what they do, and they're eager."
Bulwer tilted his head, a curious sparrow in a branch.
"They haven't been corrupted, if that's what you fear, my lord. That's always a danger when you send a man to pretend to be what he isn't. But I have a keen nose for the signs."
"Keep them close, Bulwer. After today, with luck, there might not be much of Massima's army left to spy on in any case. There might not even be a Massima to worry about." Perrin scrambled down the brushy reverse slope, past where the Mayenner and Gildanin lancers were waiting beside their horses in the thick mist, streamered lances propped on their shoulders or steel heads driven into the ground. The winged guards' red-painted helmets and breastplates might have been safe enough on the ridgetop, but not the Gildanin's burnished armor, and since Galen and Arganda both bristled if one was favored over the other, both waited here. The fog extended quite some distance. Niald claimed that was intentional, but the man had smelled surprised and pleased when he realized what he had done. So Perrin was still walking through grayness when he reached the bottom of the ridge, where all of the high-wheeled carts stood in a line with horses hitched. The dim figures of Kyrianan cart drivers moved about them, checking harness, tightening the ropes that held the canvas covers on. Massima was waiting, and Perrin wanted nothing so much as to chew off the man's arm, but he spotted the stout shape of Basil Gill beside one of the carts and headed that way. Linny was with him, wrapped in a dark cloak, and Brianna with her arm around the waist of Lamgwin, Perrin's hulking manservant. Master Gill snatched off his brimmed hat to reveal thin graying hair combed back over a bald spot that it failed to cover. Linny sniffed and pointedly avoided looking at Perrin while pretending to adjust her cowl. She smelled of anger and fear. Master Gill just smelled of fear. "It's time for you to start north, Master Gill," Perrin said. "When you reach the mountains, follow them until you strike the Johanna Road. With luck, we'll catch you up before you reach the mountains, but if not, send Aleandra's servants off to Johanna, then you head east through the pass, then north again. We'll be as close behind you as we can." If his plan did not go too far awry, light, he was a blacksmith, not a soldier. But even Ty Lee had finally agreed it was a good plan.
"I will not leave this spot until I know that Megden is safe," Linny told the fog, her thin voice a reed of iron. "And the Lady Fael, of course."
Master Gill rubbed a hand back over his head.
"My lord, Lamgwin and I were thinking maybe we could help out. The Lady Fael means a great deal to us, and Megden is one of our own. I know one end of a sword from the other, and so does Lamgwin."
He was wearing one belted around his bulk, yet if he had handled a sword these past 20 years, Perrin would eat the whole great length of that belt. Brianna's grip on Lamgwin tightened, but the big man patted her shoulder and rested his other hand on the hilt of a short sword. The fog obscured his scarred face and sunken knuckles. He was a tavern brawler, though a good man even so, but never a swordsman.
"You're my Shambayan, Master Gill," Perrin said firmly. "It's your duty to get the cart drivers and grooms and servants to safety. Yours and Lamgwin's. Now go on with you and see to it.
The stout man nodded reluctantly. Brianna breathed a small sigh of relief when Lamgwen knuckled his forehead in acquiescence. Perrin doubted that Lamgwen could have heard the sigh, though the man put his arm around her and murmured comforting words. Linny was not so compliant. Back stiff as a rod, she addressed the fog again.
"I will not leave this spot until I know—"
Perrin slapped his hands together with a loud crack, startling her into looking at him in surprise.
"All you can do here is catch the ague from standing in the damp. That and die if the Shido manage to break through. I'll bring Fael out. I'll bring Megden and the others out."
He would, or die himself in the attempt. There was no point saying that, though, and reason not to. They had to believe in their bones that he would be following with Fael and the rest.
"And you are going north, Linny. Fael will be upset with me if I let anything happen to you. Master Gil, you make sure she rides with you if you have to tie her up and put her in the back of a cart."
Master Gil jerked, crumpling his hat between his hands. He smelled of alarm suddenly, and Linny of pure indignation. Amusement filled Lamgwen's scent, and he rubbed at his nose as though concealing a smile, but strangely, Brianna was indignant too. Well, he had never claimed to understand women. If he could not understand the woman he was married to, which he could not half the time, then it was unlikely he ever would understand the rest of them. In the end, Linny actually climbed up beside the driver of a cart without having to be forced, though she slapped away Master Gil's hand when he tried to assist her, and the line of carts began to trundle off northward through the fog. Behind one of the carts, laden with the Wise One's tents and possessions, marched a cluster of white-clad Gaishine, meek even now, men and women with their cowls up and their eyes lowered. They were Shido, taken at Kyrian, and in a few months they would put off white and return to their clan. Perrin had had them watched discreetly, despite the Wise One's assurances that they would adhere to Geato in this regard, whatever others they abandoned, yet it appeared the Wise Ones were right. They still numbered 17. None had tried to run off and warn the Shido beyond the ridge. The cart's axles had been greased liberally, but they still creaked and squealed to his ears. With luck, he and Fael would catch up to them, shy of the mountains. As the strings of spare mounts began to pass him, on long leads held by mounted grooms, a maiden appeared in the mist, coming down the line of carts. Slowly, she resolved into Sulin, shufa around her neck to bear her short white hair, and black veil hanging down onto her chest. A fresh slash across her left cheek would add another scar to her face unless she accepted healing from one of the sisters. She might not. Maidens seemed to have odd attitudes about Wise One's apprentices, or maybe it was just that these apprentices were Aes Sedai. They even saw Anura as an apprentice, though she was not. "The Shido sentries to the north are dead, Perrin Ebarra," she said, "and the men who are going out to replace them. They danced well for Shido."
"You took casualties?" he asked quietly.
"Elienda and Brienne woke from their dream."
She might have been speaking of the weather rather than two deaths among women she knew.
"We all must wake eventually. We had to carry Avielen the last 2 miles. She will need healing."
So, she would accept it. "I'll send one of the Aes Sedai with you," he said, looking around in the fog. Aside from the line of horses passing him, he could see nothing. "As soon as I can find one." They found him almost as he spoke, Anura and Masuri striding out of the fog, leading their horses, with Berylaine and Massima, his shaven head glistening damply. Even in the mist, there was no mistaking the rumpled nature of the man's brown coat or the crude darn on the shoulder. None of the gold his followers looted stuck to his hands. It all went to the poor. That was the only good that could be said of Massima. But then a fair number of the poor that gold went to feed had been made poor by having their possessions stolen and their shops or farms burned by Massima's people. For some reason, Berylaine was wearing the coronet of the first of Mayenne this morning, the golden hawk in flight above her brow, though her riding dress and cloak were plain dark gray. Beneath her light, flowery perfume, her scent was patience and anxiety, as odd a combination as Perrin had ever smelled. The 6 Wise Ones were with them, too,
dark shawls draped over their arms, folded kerchiefs around their temples, holding back their long hair. With all their necklaces and bracelets of gold and ivory, they made Berlin appear simply dressed for once. Aram was one of their number as well, the wolf-head pommel of his sword rising above one red-striped shoulder, and the fog could not hide the absence of his habitual glower. The man gravitated toward Massima and seemed almost to bask in some light that Massima gave off. Perrin wondered whether he should have sent Aram with the carts, but if he had, he was sure Aram would have leaped off and sneaked back as soon as he was out of Perrin's sight. He explained Aviellan's need to the two Aes Sedai, but to his surprise, when Missouri said she would come, fair-haired Edara raised a hand that stopped the slim brown in her tracks. Anura shifted uncomfortably. She was no apprentice, and uneasy over Sionid and Missouri's relationship with the Wise Ones. They tried to include her in it, and sometimes succeeded.
"Janina will see to it," Edara said. "She has more skill than you, Missouri Sakawa."
Masuri's mouth tightened, but she kept silent. The Wise Ones were quite capable of switching an apprentice for speaking up at the wrong time, even if she did happen to be an Aes Sedai. Sulin led Janina, a flaxen-haired woman who never seemed to be ruffled by anything, off into the fog, Janina striding as quickly as Sulin, despite her bulky skirts. So the Wise Ones had learned healing, had they? That might be useful later in the day. The light send it was not needed often. Watching the pair disappear into the murk, Massima grunted. The thick mist hid the ever-burning intensity of his deep-set eyes and obscured the triangular white scar on his cheek, but his scent was full in Perrin's nose, hard and sharp as a freshly stropped razor, yet twitching in a frenzy. That smell of madness sometimes made him think his nose must bleed from breathing it. "Bad enough you use these blasphemous women, who do what only the Lord Dragon, blessed be his name, may do," Massima said, his voice full of the heat that the fog concealed in his eyes. The colors spinning in Perrin's head turned into a brief image of Rand and Min, and a tall man in a black coat, an Ashaman, and he felt a shock right down to his boots. Rand's left hand was gone. No matter. Whatever had happened, it happened. And today his business lay elsewhere. "But if they know healing," Massima continued, "it will be that much harder to kill the savages. A pity you won't let the Shan-Chan leash all of them." His sidelong glance at Anura and Missouri said he included them, despite the fact both had visited him in secret more than once. They regarded him with Aes Sedai calm, though Missouri's slim hands moved once as if to smooth her brown skirts. She said she had changed her mind and now believed the man must be killed, so why was she meeting him? Why was Anura? Why did Massima allow them? He more than hated Aes Sedai. Perhaps answers could be found now that Javiar and Narion no longer needed protection. Behind Massima, the Wise Ones stirred. Fire-haired Garel, who looked as if she possessed a temper, though she did not, actually stroked the hilt of her belt knife. And Navarin, who could have given Nynaeve lessons in getting angry, gripped hers. Massima should have felt those eyes boring into his back, but his scent never shifted. Insane he might be, but never a coward.
"You wanted to speak to Lord Perrin, my Lord Prophet?" Berylaine said gently, though Perrin could smell the strain of her smile.
Massima stared at her.
"I am simply the prophet of the Lord Dragon, not a lord. The Lord Dragon is the only lord now. His coming has shattered all bonds and destroyed all titles. Kings and queens, lords and ladies are but dust beneath his feet."
Those whirling hues threatened again, but Perrin crushed them.
"What are you doing here?" he demanded.
There was no way to soften moments with Massima. The man was as hard as a good file.
"You're supposed to be with your men. You risked being seen by coming here, and you'll risk it again going back. I don't trust your people to hold for 5 minutes without you there to stiffen their spines. They'll run as soon as they see the Shido coming their way."
"They are not my people, Ibarra. They are the Lord Dragon's people."
Light being around Massima meant having to stomp on those colors every few minutes.
"I left Nengar in charge. He has fought more battles than you have dreamed of, including against the savages. I also gave the women orders to kill any man who tries to run,
and have let it be known that I will hunt down anyone who escapes the women. They will hold to the last man, Ibarra."
"You sound as if you're not going back," Perrin said.
"I intend to stay close to you."
Fog might hide the heat in Massima's eyes, but Perrin could feel it.
"A pity if any misfortune should befall you just as you reclaim your wife."
So a small part of his plan had unraveled already. A hope, really, rather than part of the plan. If all else went well, the Shido who managed to flee would carve a way through Massima's people without more than slowing a step. But instead of taking a Shido spear through his ribs, Massima would be keeping an eye on him. Without any doubt, the man's bodyguard was not far off in the fog, 200 or so ruffians better armed and better mounted than the rest of his army. Perrin did not look at Berylane, but the scent of her worry had strengthened. Massima had reason to want both of them dead. He would warn Galen that his primary task today would be protecting Berylane from Massima's men, and he would have to watch his own back. Off in the fog, a brief flash of silver-blue light appeared, and he frowned. It was too early yet for Grady. Two figures coalesced out of the mist. One was Niald, not strutting for once. In fact, he stumbled. His face looked tired. Burn him, why was he wasting his strength this way? The other was a young Seanchan in lacquered armor with a single thin plume on the peculiar helmet he carried beneath his arm. Perrin recognized him. Gwaya Araba, a Lieutenant Tylee thought well of. The two Aes Sedai gathered their skirts as if to keep him from brushing against them, though he went nowhere near them. For his part, he missed a step when he came close enough to make out their faces, and Perrin heard him swallow hard. He smelled skittish of a sudden. Araba's bow included Perrin and Berylane, and he frowned slightly at Massima as though wondering what such a ragged fellow was doing in their company. Massima sneered, and the Seanchan's free hand drifted toward his sword hilt before he stopped it. They seemed touchy folk, Seanchan did, but Araba did not waste time.
"Banner General Kirgan's compliments, my lord, my lady first. Morat Rakan report those bands of Aiel are moving faster than expected. They will arrive sometime today, possibly as soon as noon. The group to the west is perhaps 25,000 or 30,000, the one to the east larger by a third. About half of them are wearing white, and there will be children, of course, but that is still a lot of spears to have behind you. The Banner General wishes to know if you would like to discuss altering the deployments. She suggests moving a few thousand of the Altaran Lancers to join you."
Perrin grimaced. There would be at least 3,000 or 4,000 Algaid Siswai with each of those bands. A lot of spears to have at his back for certain sure. Niald yawned. "How are you feeling, Niald?"
"Oh, I'm ready to do whatever needs doing, I am, my lord,"
the man said, with just a hint of his usual jauntiness. Perrin shook his head. The Ashaman could not be asked to make one gateway more than necessary. He prayed that they would not fall one short.
"By noon, we'll be done here. Tell the Banner General we go ahead as planned.
And pray that nothing else went amiss." He did not add that aloud, though. Out in the fog, wolves howled, an eerie cry that rose all around Maldon. It was truly begun now.
"You're doing wonderfully, Megden," Fael croaked. She felt lightheaded, and her throat was dry from encouraging the woman. Everyone's throat was dry. By the slant of the light coming through the gaps overhead, it was near mid-morning, and they'd been talking without cease for most of that. They had tried tapping the unbroken barrels, but the wine inside was too rancid even for wetting lips. Now they were taking turns with the encouragement. She was sitting alongside her sun-haired maid while the others rested against the back wall, as far from that leaning jumble of boards and timbers as they could get. "You're going to save us, Megden." Above them, the red scarf was just visible through that narrow gap in the tangle. It had hung limply for some time now, except when the breeze caught it. Megden stared at it fixedly. Her dirty face glistened with sweat, and she breathed as if she had been running hard. Suddenly the scarf went taut and began to swing once, twice, three times. Then the breeze sent it fluttering and it fell. Megden continued to stare. That was beautiful, Fael said hoarsely. The other woman was getting tired. More time was passing between each success, and the successes were lasting a shorter time. It was... Abruptly a face appeared beside the scarf, one hand gripping the length of red. For a moment she thought she must be imagining it. Aravine's face, framed by her white cowl. I see her, the woman said excitedly. I see the Lady Fael and Megden. They're alive! Voices raised a cheer, quickly stilled. Megden swayed as if she might fall over, but a beautiful smile wreathed her face. Fael heard weeping behind her, and wanted to weep with joy herself. Friends had found them, not Shido. They might escape yet. Pushing herself to her feet, she moved closer to the leaning pile of charred rubble. She tried to work moisture into her mouth, but it was thick. We're all alive, she managed in a husky voice. How in the light did you find us? It was Theril, my lady, Aravine replied. The scamp followed you despite your orders, and the light bless him for it. He saw Galena leave and the building fall in, and he thought you were dead. He sat down and cried. A voice protested in rough Amadisian accents, and Aravine turned her head for a moment. I know someone who's been crying when I see him, boy. You just be thankful you stopped to cry. When he saw the scarf move, my lady, he came running for help. You tell him there's no shame in tears, Fael said. Tell him I've seen my husband cry when tears were called for. My lady, Aravine said hesitantly. He said Galena pulled on a timber when she came out. It was set like a lever, he said. He said she made the building collapse. Why would she do that? Aleandra demanded. She had helped Megden to her feet and half supported her to reach Fael's side. Lassiel and Arala joined them, alternating between tears and laughter. Aleandra's face was a thunderhead. Fael grimaced. How often in the last few hours had she wished she had that slap back? Galena had promised. Could the woman be Black Aja? That doesn't matter now. One way or another I'll see her repaid. How was another matter? Galena was Aes Sedai, after all. Aravine, how many people did you bring? Can you... Large hands took Aravine by the shoulders and moved her aside. Enough talk. Roland's face appeared in the gap, shufa around his neck and veil hanging onto his chest. Roland! We cannot clear anything with you standing there, Fael Bashir. This thing may fall in when we start. Go to the other end and huddle against the far wall. What are you doing here? She demanded. The man chuckled. He chuckled. You still wear white, woman. Do as you are told. Or when I have you out of there, I will smack your bottom soundly. And then maybe we will soothe your tears with a kissing game. She showed him her teeth, hoping he did not take it for a grin. But he was right about them needing to move away, so she led her companions across the board-strewn stone floor to the far end of the basement, where they crouched against the wall. She could hear voices muttering outside, likely discussing exactly how to go about clearing a path without making the rest of the building collapse on her head. All this for nothing, Aleandra said bitterly. How many Shido do you suppose are up there? Wood scraped loudly, and with a groan the leaning pile of rubble leaned inward a little more. The voices began again. I haven't any idea, Fael told her, but they must all be Meridin, not Shido. The Shido did not mingle with the brotherless. There might be some hope in that. Surely Roland would let her go once he learned about Dairane. Of course he would. And if he remained stubborn, in that case she would do whatever was necessary to convince him. Perrin would never have to find out. Wood scraped on wood again, and once more the heap of burned timbers and boards tilted inward a little further.
The fog hid the sun, but Perrin estimated it must be near mid-morning. Grady would be coming soon. He should have been there by now. If the man had grown too tired to make another gateway. No, Grady would come. Soon. But his shoulders were as tight as if he had been working a forge for a full day and longer. I tell you, I don't like this one bit, Galen muttered. In the thick mist, his red eye patch was just another shadow.
His heavy-chested bay nosed his back, impatient to be moving, and he patted the animal's neck absently.
If Massima really wants to kill the lady first, I say we finish him now. We outnumber him. We can overwhelm his bodyguard in minutes.
Fool,
Arganda growled, glancing off to his right as if he could see Massima and his men through the curling grayness. Unlike the Mayenner, he had put on his silvered helmet with its three fat white plumes. It and his breastplate, worked in gold and silver, glistened with condensation. Fog or no fog, his armor seemed almost to glow.
You think we can kill 200 men without making a sound? Shouts will be heard the other side of this ridge. You have your ruler where you can surround her with 900 men and maybe get her away. Alejandra is still in that bloody town and surrounded by Shido.
Galen bristled, hand going to his sword hilt, as though he might practice on Arganda before moving on to Massima.
We're not killing anybody but Shido today, Perrin said firmly.
Galen grunted, but he did not try to argue. He stank of discontent, though. Protecting Berylane would keep the winged guards out of the fighting. Off to the left, a bluish flash appeared, dimmed by the thick mist, and the tightness in Perrin's shoulders loosened. Grady appeared in the fog, peering about him. His step picked up when he saw Perrin, but it was unsteady. Another man was with him, leading a tall, dark horse. Perrin smiled for the first time in a long while.
"It's good to see you, Tam," he said.
"Good to see you, too, my lord."
Tam Althor was still a blocky man who looked ready to work from sunup to sundown without slacking, but the hair on his head had gone completely gray since Perrin had seen him last, and he had a few more lines on his bluff face. He took in Arganda and Galen with a steady gaze. Fancy armor did not impress him.
"How are you holding up, Grady?" Perrin asked.
"I'm holding up, my lord."
The weathered man's voice sounded bone-weary. Shadowed by the fog as it was, his face still looked older than Tam's.
"Well, as soon as you're done here, join Mishima. I want somebody keeping an eye on him. Somebody who makes him too nervous to think they can change what they agreed to."
He would have liked to tell Grady to tie off this gateway. It would make a short path to take Fael back to the two rivers. But if things went wrong today, it would make a short path for the Shido, too.
"Don't know as I could make a cat nervous right now, my lord, but I'll do what I can."
Frowning, Tam watched Grady vanish into the gray murk.
"I could wish I'd had some other way to get here," he said. "Fellows like him visited the two rivers a while back. One called himself Mazrim Taim, a name we'd all heard. A false dragon, only now he wears a black coat with fancy embroidery and calls himself the Mahail. They talked everywhere about teaching men to channel, about this black tower." He freighted the words with sourness. "The village councils tried to put a stop to it, and the women's circles, but they ended up taking about 40 men and boys with them. Thank the light some listened to sense, or I think they'd have had 10 times that."
His gaze shifted to Perrin.
"Taim said Rand sent him. He said Rand is the dragon reborn."
There was a touch of questioning in that, perhaps a hope for denial, perhaps a demand to know why Perrin had kept silent. Those hues whirled in Perrin's head, but he batted them away and answered by not answering. What was, was.
"Nothing to be done about it now, Tam."
According to Grady and Niald, the Black Tower did not just let men go once they signed on. Sadness entered Tam's scent, though he let nothing show on his face. He knew the fate of men who could channel. Grady and Niald claimed the male half of the source was clean now, but Perrin could not see how that could be. What was, was. You did the job you were given, followed the road you had to follow, and that was that. There was no point complaining about blisters or rocks underfoot. Perrin went on.
"This is Bertin Galen, Lord Captain of the Winged Guards, and Gerard Arganda, First Captain of the Legion of the Wall."
Arganda shrugged uncomfortably. That name carried political weight in Gil-Dan, and apparently Alejandra had not felt strong enough to announce that she was reconstituting the Legion. Balwer had a nose for sniffing out secrets, though. This one made sure Arganda would not go wild trying to reach his queen.
Galen, Arganda, this is Tamel Thor. He's my first captain. You studied the map, Tam, and my plan?
I studied them, my lord, Tam said dryly.
Of course he would have.
It looks a good plan to me. As good as any till the arrows start flying.
Arganda put a booted foot in his roan's stirrup.
So long as he's your first captain, my lord, I have no objections.
He had offered plenty earlier. Neither he nor Galen had been pleased that Perrin was putting someone over them. From up the slope came a black-winged mocker's shrill cry of alarm. Only one. If it had been a real bird, the call would have been repeated. Perrin scrambled up the slope as fast as he could. Arganda and Galen passed him on their mounts, but they divided to ride to their men, disappearing into the thick gray haze. Perrin continued to the top and beyond. Danil was standing almost at the edge of the fog, peering toward the Shido encampment. He pointed, but the reason for the alarm was obvious. A large group of Elgaid Siswai was leaving the tents, maybe 400 or more. The Shido sent out raiding parties frequently, but this one was aimed straight at Perrin. They were just walking, but it would not take them long to reach the ridge.
It's time to let them see us, Danil, he said, unpinning his cloak and draping it over a low bush.
He would come back for it later, if he could. It would only get in his way now. Danil sketched a bow before hurrying back into the trees as Aram appeared, sword already in hand. He smelled eager. The cloak pin Perrin put into his pocket carefully. Fael had given him that. He did not want to lose it. His fingers found the leather cord he had knotted for every day of her captivity. Pulling it out, he let it fall to the ground without glancing at it. This morning had seen the last knot. Tucking his thumbs behind the wide belt that supported his hammer and belt knife, he strolled out of the fog. Aram advanced up on his toes, already in one of those sword stances. Perrin just walked. The morning sun, indeed halfway to its noon peak, was in his eyes. He had considered taking the eastern ridge and putting Massima's men here, but it would have meant that much further to reach the town gates. A foolish reason, yet those gates drew him as a lodestone drew iron filings. He eased his heavy hammer in its loop on his belt, eased his belt knife. That had a blade as long as his hand. The appearance of two men, apparently walking idly toward them, was enough to halt the Shido. Well, perhaps not so idly, considering Aram's sword. They would have to be blind to miss the sun glinting off his long blade. They must have been wondering whether they were watching madmen. Halfway down the slope, he stopped.
Relax, he told Aram. You're going to tire yourself out that way.
The other man nodded without taking his eyes from the Shido and planted his feet firmly. His scent was that of a hunter after dangerous quarry and determined to pull it down. After a moment, half a dozen of the Shido started toward them, slowly. They had not veiled. Likely they were hoping he and Aram would not be frightened into running. Among the tents, people were pointing at the two fools on the slope. The sound of running boots and hooves and snorting horses made him look over his shoulder. Arganda's Gil Danan appeared out of the fog first in their burnished breastplates and helmets, riding behind a rippling red banner that bore the 3 6-pointed silver stars of Giladan, and then the winged guards in their red armor behind the golden hawk on a field of blue of Mayenne. Between them, Danil began arraying the two rivers men in three ranks. Every man carried a pair of bristling quivers at his belt and also a bundle of shafts that he stuck point down into the slope before slicing the binding cords. They wore their swords and short swords, but the halberds and other pole arms had been left on the carts this morning. One of them had brought along the red wolf-head banner, but the staff was stuck aslant into the ground behind them. No one could be spared to carry the thing. Danil carried a bow, too. Massima and his bodyguard of lancers took position on the winged guard's right, their poorly handled horses plunging and rearing. Their armor showed patches of speckled brown where rust had been scraped away instead of properly cleaned. Massima himself was out in front, a sword at his hip, but helmetless and without a breastplate. No, he did not lack courage.
He was glaring at the Mayenners, where Perrin could just make out Berylaine in the middle of that forest of lances. He could not get a clear view of her face, but he imagined it was still frosty. She had objected strenuously to her soldiers being held back from the fighting, and he had needed to be very firm to make her see reason. Like the woman had half suggested, she might lead them in a charge. The wise ones and the two Aes Sedai filed down between the Gil-Danann and the two riversmen, accompanied by the maidens, each of whom had long strips of red cloth tied around her upper arms and dangling to the wrist. He could not pick out Avielen, but by their number she must be among them, newly healed or not. Black veils covered their faces except for their eyes, yet he did not need to see their faces or catch their scents to know they were indignant. The markings were necessary to avoid accidents, but Idara had had to put her foot down to make them wear the things. Bracelets of gold and ivory rattled as Idara adjusted her dark shawl. With smooth, sun-dark cheeks that seemed darker because of her pale yellow hair, she looked little older than Perrin, but her blue eyes held an unshakable calm. He suspected she was far older than she appeared. Those eyes had seen a great deal. "I think it will begin soon, Perrin Ebarra," she said. Perrin nodded. The gates called to him. The appearance of near enough 2,000 lancers and 200-odd bowmen was sufficient to make the Shido below raise their veils and spread out, while more began rushing from the tents to join them in a thick, lengthening line. Pointing fingers along that line, pointing spears, made him look back again. Tam was on the slope now, and more Two Rivers men were pouring out of the fog with longbows in hand. Some tried to mingle with the men who had followed Perrin, to reunite with brothers, sons, nephews, friends, but Tam chivied them away, trotting his black gelding up and down as he arranged them in three ever-expanding ranks, to either side of the horsemen. Perrin spotted Hugh Barron and his equally lanky brother Tad, the stableman from the Winespring Inn, and square-faced Bar Dautry, only a few years older than he himself was, who was making a name for himself as cabinet-maker, and skinny Thad Torfin, who seldom left his farm except to come into Emmons Field. Orin Dautry, lean and tall, stood between John A. Ellen, who was hulking and bald, and Kev Barstier, who finally had gotten out from under his mother's thumb if he was here. There were Marwins and Aldeas, Alcines and Coles, Thanes and Alcars and Craws, men from every family he knew, men he did not recognize, from down to Devon Ride or up to Watch Hill or Terran Ferry, all grim-faced and burdened with pairs of bristling quivers and extra sheaves of arrows. And among them stood others, men with coppery skins, men with transparent veils across the lower half of their faces, fair-skinned men who just did not have the look of the Two Rivers. They carried shorter bows, of course. It took a lifetime to learn the Two Rivers' longbow, but every face he could make out looked as determined as any Two Rivers man. What in the light were the outlanders doing here? On and on the streams of running men continued until finally those three long lines held at least 3,000 men, maybe four. Tam walked his horse down the slope to Perrin and sat studying the swelling Shido ranks below, yet he seemed to hear Perrin's unspoken question. "I asked for volunteers from the Two Rivers men and picked the best bow shots, but those you took in started coming forward in groups. You gave them and their families homes, and they said they were Two Rivers men too now. Some of those bows won't carry much more than 200 paces, but the men I chose hit what they aim at." Below, the Shido began beating their spears rhythmically against their bullhide bucklers. Rat-tat-tat-tat, rat-tat-tat-tat, rat-tat-tat-tat. The sound rose like thunder. The flow of veiled shapes running out from the tents slowed to a trickle, then dwindled further, and then ceased. All of the Algide Siswai had been drawn out, it seemed. That was the plan, after all. There must have been 20,000 of them, near enough, all pounding their bucklers. Rat-tat-tat-tat, rat-tat-tat-tat, rat-tat-tat-tat. "After the Aiel War, I hope never to hear that again," Tam said loudly, to be heard. That noise could get on a man's nerves. "Will you give the command, Lord Perrin?" "You do it." Perrin eased his hammer again, his belt knife. His eyes kept going from the Shido to the town gates and the dark mass of the fortress inside the town. Fael was in there.
"Soon now we will know," Adara said. About the tea, she meant.
If they had not waited long enough, they were all dead. Her voice was calm, though. Aram shifted, up on his toes again, sword upright before him in both hands.
Perrin could hear Tam calling as he rode along the lines of bowmen. "Long bows, knock! Short bows, hold till you're close! Long bows, knock! Short bows, hold till you're close! Don't draw, you fool, you know better! Long bows!"
Below, perhaps a quarter of the Shido turned and began trotting north, paralleling the ridge, still beating their bucklers. Another quarter began trotting south. They intended to sweep around and catch the men on the slope from either side. Flanking, Tylee called it. A ripple passed through those remaining as they began sticking their spears through the harness holding their bowcases, hanging their bucklers on their belts, unlimbering their bows.
"Very soon," Adara murmured.
A fireball larger than a man's head arched out from the tents toward the ridge, then another twice the size and more, streams of them. Sailing high, the first turned down and exploded with loud roars 100 paces overhead. In rapid succession, the others began exploding harmlessly too, but more followed, spheres of flame speeding toward the ridge in a continuous flow. Forked silver lightning stabbed down from a cloudless sky, interrupted with booming crashes of thunder and great showers of sparks, without ever coming near the ground.
"Perhaps 15 or 20 wise ones escaped the tea," Adara said. "Otherwise more would have joined in by now. I can see only 9 women channeling. The rest must be among the tents."
She disliked the agreement he had with the Shonchan almost as much as the Aes Sedai did, yet her voice was calm. In her book, the Shido had violated Jiatou to such a degree that it was questionable whether they could be called Aiel any longer. To her, they were something that had to be cut out of the body of the Aiel, and their wise ones were the worst of the sickness for allowing it. Masuri drew her arm back, but Adara laid a hand on her shoulder.
"Not yet, Masuri Sakawa. We will tell you when."
Masuri nodded obediently, though she smelled of impatience.
"Well, I, for one, feel in danger," Anora said firmly, drawing her arm back.
Adara looked at her levelly. After a moment, the Aes Sedai lowered her arm. Her beaded braids clicked together as she twisted her head away from the wise one's stare. Her scent was of strong unease.
"Perhaps I can wait a little longer," she muttered.
The fireballs hurtling across the sky continued to explode far above. The lightning jabbed toward the ridge, but the Shido below were not waiting. With a shout, the main mass began trotting quickly toward the ridge, and singing at the tops of their lungs. Perrin doubted anyone else on the slope could make out more than a roar, but his ears caught words faintly. They were singing in parts. "Wash the spears while the sun climbs high. Wash the spears while the sun falls low. Wash the spears, who fears to die? Wash the spears, no one I know." He shut the sound out, ignoring it, while his eyes drifted beyond the onrushing mass of veiled figures to the gates of Maldon. Iron filings to a lodestone. The shapes below seemed to have slowed half a step, though he knew they had not. Everything seemed to slow down for him at times like this. How long before they came in range? They had covered little more than half the distance to the ridge.
"Longbows raise, on my signal," Tam shouted. "Longbows raise, on my signal."
Perrin shook his head. It was too soon. Thousands of bowstrings snapped behind him. Arrows arced over his head. The sky seemed black with them. Seconds later, another flight followed, then a third. Fireballs burned swaths through them, but it was still thousands of arrows that fell in a deadly hail onto the Shido. Of course. He had forgotten to factor in the bowman's elevation. That gave them a little more distance. Trust Tam to see it right away. Not every arrow struck a man, of course. Many plunged into the ground. Perhaps half struck Algaid Siswai, piercing arms or legs, striking bodies. Wounded Shido hardly slowed, even when they had to struggle up from the ground. They left hundreds lying still, though, and the second flight put down hundreds more, as did the third, with the fourth and fifth already on the way. The Shido kept coming, leaning forward as if trotting into a driving rain, while their wise ones' balls of fire and lightnings exploded far overhead. They were no longer singing. Some raised their bows and shot. An arrow grazed Perrin's left arm, but the rest fell short. Not by far, though. Another 20 paces, and the sudden sharp sound of Seanchan horns pulled his gaze north and south just in time to see the ground erupt in fountains of fire among the flanking parties. Spears of lightning stabbed into them. The Damani were being kept back in the trees for the time, but they did deadly work. Again and again explosions of fire or lightning hurled men like twigs. Those Elguide Siswai could have no idea where the attack was coming from. They began to run toward the trees, toward their killers. Some of the fireballs coming out of the camp began flying toward the forests where the Damani were, and lightnings jabbed toward the trees, but with as little effect as they had against the ridge. Ty Lee claimed Damani were used for all sorts of tasks, but the truth was they were weapons of war, and they and the Suldam were very good at it. "Now," Adara said, and fireballs began raining down on the Shido below. The Wise Ones and Aes Sedai made throwing motions with both arms as fast as they could, and every time a ball of flame seemed to rise from their fingertips. Many of those exploded too soon, of course. The Shido Wise Ones were working to defend their own. But the Elguide Siswai were much nearer to the ridge, so they had less time to react. Fireballs burst among the Shido, hurling men aside, flinging severed arms and legs into the air. Silver-blue lightning bolts forked down, and most of those struck too. The hair on Perrin's arms stirred. The hair on his head tried to stand. The air seemed to crackle with the lightning's discharges. Even as they flung death at the men below, Adara and the others continued to parry the Shido Wise One's attacks, and all the while the Two Rivers men worked their bows as fast as they could. A trained man could loose 12 shafts in a minute, and the range was shorter now. The Shido lacked no more than 200 paces of reaching the bottom of the ridge. Their arrows still fell short of Perrin, but the Two Rivers' arrows were striking home every time at this range. Each bowman was picking his own target, of course, so Perrin saw Elguide Siswai fall pierced by 2, 3, even 4 shafts. Flesh could only take so much. The Shido began to fall back. It was not a rout. They did not flee. Many shot arrows back at the ridge despite no hope of making the range. But they turned as if on a command and ran, trying to outpace the Two Rivers' shafts and the rain of fire and lightning that pursued them. The flankers were falling back too, as lancers appeared out of the trees, forming ranks 1,000 horses wide, advancing slowly while fire and lightning harried the Shido.
"By ranks," Tam shouted. "Advance 3 paces and loose." "Advance at a walk," Arganda bellowed. "With me," Massima shouted.
Perrin was supposed to take that slow advance with the others, but he began to walk down the slope faster and faster. The gates tugged at him. His blood was becoming fire. Elias claimed it was a natural feeling when you were in danger of your life, but he could not see it. He had almost drowned in the Waterwood once, and he had felt nothing like this thrill that was surging through him now. Someone behind shouted his name, but he trotted on, picking up speed. Freeing his hammer from its belt loop, he drew his belt knife with his left hand. Aram was running beside him, he realized, but his own focus was on the gates, on the Shido who still stood between him and Fael. Fire, lightning, and arrows fell among them like hail, and they were no longer turning to fire their own arrows, though they often looked over their shoulders. But many were supporting wounded, men who dragged a leg or clutched a side with a Two Rivers shaft jutting from it, and he was catching up. Abruptly, 6 veiled men turned back, gripping spears, and started toward him and Aram at a run. Not using their bows meant they had expended their arrows. He had heard tales of champions, of men who decided the future by single combat between 2 armies that would abide by the outcome. The Aiel had no such tales. He did not slow down, though. His blood was fire. He was fire. A Two Rivers shaft took one Shido in the middle of his chest, and even as he fell, 3 more were feathered with at least 12 arrows each. But now he and Aram were too close to the remaining 2. Anyone but the very best bow shots would risk hitting him or Aram if he fired. Aram flowed toward one of the Shido as if dancing, his blade a bright blur, but Perrin had no time to watch anyone else fight if he had wanted to. A veiled man who overtopped him by a head stabbed at him with a short spear held near its base. Blocking the spear with his belt knife, Perrin swung his hammer. The Shido tried to stop it with his buckler, but he altered the swing slightly, and heard the bones in the man's forearm snap under 10 pounds of steel swung by a blacksmith's arm. He was inside the spear now, and without slowing, he slashed across the man's throat with his knife. Blood gouted, and he was running again while the man was falling. He had to reach Fael. Fire in his blood, fire in his heart, fire in his head. No one and nothing would keep him from Fael.
Chapter 30. Outside the Gates. Fael tried to estimate the time by the slant of light falling through the gaps in the ruined building overhead. It seemed still short of noon. All that had been cleared was a small space at the very top of the basement stairs. Any of them could have passed through it if they dared to try climbing the slanting pile of blackened rubble, but that still looked as though it might fall in any moment. The tangled heap still creaked alarmingly at times. The only good thing was that it had not started raining on their heads. How long that would last was a question. She had been hearing thunder for some time, quite a lot of it, and slowly coming closer. The booms were almost continuous. A storm that fierce might be enough to make the building finish collapsing. Light, she was thirsty. Roland suddenly appeared in the opening and lay down on the stone landing. He was not wearing the harness that held his bow case. Carefully he wriggled his way out onto the rubble. The pile groaned softly under his weight. Kinwin, a green-eyed man a good hand or more shorter than he, knelt to grip his ankles. There were only 3 of the Brotherless up there, it seemed, but that was 3 too many. Head and shoulders sticking over the edge of the rubble, Roland lowered one arm. "There is no more time, Fael Bashir. Take my hand." "Megdin first," Fael said thickly, waving away the sun-haired woman's weary protests. Light, but her mouth was coated with grit, and too dry to spit any of it out. "Arla and Lucille next. I'll go last." Aleandra nodded approvingly, but Arla and Lucille tried to object, too. "Be quiet and do as I say," she told them firmly. Thunder crashed and crashed. The storm that produced that much thunder would bring a deluge, not simple rainfall. Roland laughed. How could the man laugh at a time like this? He only stopped when the charred timbers beneath him groaned again from his shaking. "You still wear white, woman, so be quiet and do as I say." There was a touch of mocking in his tone at that, but not when he added, "No one will be taken out before you." That sounded like cast iron. "My lady," Aleandra said quietly, hoarsely, "I believe he means it. I will send the others out in the order you gave." "Stop pouting and give me your hand," Roland commanded.
She was not pouting. The man could be as infuriatingly stubborn as her Perrin. Only in Perrin it was intriguing, not really infuriating.
Raising her right hand as high as it would go, she let Roland's hand envelop hers. He lifted her easily till her face was just below his.
"Catch hold of my coat."
There was no hint of strain in his voice, despite the awkward angle of his arm. "You will have to climb over me." She swung her left hand up and caught a fistful of the rough wool, holding on hard. The pain in her shoulder told her it was bruised as badly as she feared. When he released her other hand, she gasped at the jolt of agony and quickly grabbed his coat with that one, too. Grasping her waist in both hands, he boosted her higher, so she was lying on his broad back. Thunder boomed and boomed without ceasing. The rain must start falling soon. That would make getting the others out more difficult.
"I like feeling your weight on me, Fael Bashir, but maybe you could climb a little faster so I can bring the others out."
He pinched her bottom, and she laughed in spite of herself. The man just would not stop trying. The climb over him was slower than she could have hoped for. She did not believe anything was broken in her shoulder, but it hurt. Once she thought she kicked Roland in the head. Pinch her, would he? At last she was outside and past Kinwin, on her feet under the sky once more. Her first sight of the building from outside made her swallow and then cough vigorously as bits of grit entered her throat.
The charred timbers were tilting to an alarming degree, ready to crash into the basement. The third brotherless, Joradin, a blue-eyed man with red-gold hair and a face that fell not far short of prettiness, was watching Kinwin and Rolon, but every so often he glanced at the building as if expecting to see it fall. He was squat for an Aiel, not quite as tall as Perrin, but half again as wide. There must have been at least 100 of her people in the street, staring at her anxiously, some of their white robes stained with soot from their efforts at digging her out. 100. She could not find it in her heart to upbraid them, however, especially after Aravine thrust a plump waterskin into her hands. The first mouthful went to wash away grit and dust, though she wanted desperately to swallow it anyway, but after that she held up the skin and all but poured water down her throat. Her bruised shoulder protested. She ignored it and drank and drank. Suddenly she became aware of lightning striking outside the town to the west and lowered the waterskin to stare, close outside the town, out of a cloudless sky, and sometimes not striking. Many of those forked silvery bolts erupted with thunderous roars far above the ground. Balls of fire hurtled across the sky, sometimes bursting in air with a boom like thunder. Someone was fighting a battle with the power. But who? Could Perrin have found enough Aes Sedai or Ashaman to attack the camp? But something was very odd. She knew how many wise ones in the camp could channel, and there did not seem to be enough lightning or fireballs. Perhaps it was not Perrin after all. There were factions among the wise ones, not just between those supporting or opposing Savannah, but between septs with old alliances or animosities. Maybe one of those factions was fighting another. That seemed highly unlikely, but less so than Perrin finding enough Aes Sedai to attack, and the wise ones not fighting back with everything they could muster. When the lightning started, Rolon said there was a battle, Aravine said when Fael asked her. That's all. Nobody wanted to go find out more until we knew you were safe. Fael ground her teeth in frustration. Even if she did not have to deal with Rolon, whatever was going on outside the walls might make escaping that much more difficult. If only she knew what it was, she might be able to see how to avoid it, or use it. No one is to go anywhere, Aravine. It might be dangerous. And they might inadvertently lead Shido back when they returned. Light, what was going on? Megden staggered out past Kinwin, rubbing her hip. He pinched me. Her voice was thick, but indignation came through. Fael felt a stab of... not jealousy, certainly not that. The bloody man could pinch any woman he wanted to. He was not Perrin. Grimacing, she handed the sun-haired woman the waterskin, and Megden washed out her mouth hurriedly before beginning to gulp thirstily. She was not so sun-haired at the moment, her curls all sweat-matted and as coated with dust as her sweaty face. She was not even pretty at the moment. Arala came out of the ruin, rubbing her bottom and looking grim as death, but she eagerly took the waterskin that Alden offered. The tall young Amadisian, a square-shouldered fellow who looked more a soldier than the bookkeeper he was, gazed at her avidly as she drank. Arala did not like men that way, but Alden refused to accept that he could not convince her to marry him. Lucille appeared, rubbing her bottom, and Joradin handed her another waterskin, drawing a finger down her dirty cheek. She smiled up at him before beginning to drink. Already preparing her way back into his blankets, if Rolon proved obstinate. At least Fael thought that was what she was doing. At last Aleandra stalked past Kinwin, and if she was not rubbing herself, her expression of frosty ire told the tale plainly enough. Kinwin backed out of the opening and stood while Rolon began working his way back across the dangerous pile of timbers. "My lady," Aravine called anxiously, and Fael turned to find the plump-faced woman kneeling on the paving stones and lifting Megden's head onto her lap. Megden's eyelids fluttered, but never came more than half open. Her lips moved weakly, but only mumbles emerged. "What happened?" Fael said, hurrying to kneel beside them. "I don't know, my lady. She was drinking as if she intended to empty the skin, and suddenly she staggered. The next thing I knew, she just collapsed." Aravine's hands fluttered like falling leaves. "She must be very tired," Fael said, smoothing her maid's hair and trying not to think of how they were to get the woman out of the camp if she could not walk. It would be done if they had to carry her.
Light, she felt a touch wobbly herself.
She saved us, Aravine. The Amadisian woman nodded gravely.
I will hide you somewhere safe until tonight, Fail Bashir, Roland said, fastening the last buckles of his bow-case harness. His brown shufa was already wrapped around his head. Then I will take you to the forest.
Taking three short spears from Juradin, he thrust them up through the harness behind so the long spear points glinting in the sun stuck up above his head. Fail almost collapsed beside Megden with relief. There would be no need to conceal anything from Perrin, but she could not afford weakness, not now. Our supplies, she began, and as if the sound of her voice were the last straw, the building gave a squealing groan and fell in with a crash that drowned out the explosions for a moment.
I will see that you have what you need, Roland told her, raising the black veil across his face.
Juradin handed him another spear and his buckler, which he hung on his belt knife, before seizing her right arm and drawing her to her feet.
We must move quickly. I do not know who we are dancing the spears with, but the Meradin will dance today.
Alden, will you carry Megden? Was all she managed to get out, before Roland strode away, pulling her with him. She looked over her shoulder to see Alden lifting a limp Megden in his arms. Juradin had Lucille by her arm as firmly as Roland had her. The three brotherless were leading a parade of white-garbed men and women, and one boy. Theril wore a grim expression. Fumbling in her sleeve, no easy matter with Roland's big hand on her arm, she closed her fingers around the ridged hilt of her dagger. Whatever was happening outside the walls, she might have need of that blade before nightfall.
Perrin ran along the winding street through the tents. No one moved in his sight, but through the roar of exploding fireballs and lightnings he could hear other sounds of battle. Steel clashing on steel, men shouting as they killed or died, men screaming. Blood ran down the left side of his face from a gash in his scalp, and he could feel it oozing down his right side from where a spear had grazed him, oozing down his left thigh from a spear that had bitten deeper. Not all of the blood on him was his own. A face appeared at the opening to a low, dark tent, and drew back hurriedly. A child's face, and frightened, not the first he had seen. The Shida were being pressed so hard that a good many children had been left behind. That would be a problem for later, though. Over the tents, he could see the gates little more than 100 paces ahead. Beyond them lay the fortress and Fail. Two veiled Shido darted out from beside a dirty brown wall tent, spears at the ready. But not for him. They were looking at something off to the left. Without slowing, he ran into them. Both were larger than he, but the force of his rush carried them all to the ground, and he fell already fighting. His hammer smashed into the bottom of one man's chin, while he stabbed and stabbed at the other man, blade biting deep. The hammer rose and crushed the first man's face, splashing blood, rose and fell again while he stabbed. The man with the ruined face twitched once as Perrin rose. The other lay staring at the sky. A hint of motion at the corner of his left eye made him throw himself to the right. A sword whisked through the air where his neck would have been. Aram's sword. The one-time tinker had taken wounds, too. Blood coated half his face like a strange mask. There were blood-wet rents in his red-striped coat, and his eyes looked almost glazed, like those of a corpse. But he still seemed to be dancing with that blade in his hands. His scent was the scent of death, a death he sought.
"Have you gone mad?" Perrin growled.
Steel rang against steel as he blocked that sword away with the head of his hammer.
"What are you doing?"
He blocked another slice of the blade, tried to grapple the other man, and barely danced back in time to get away with only a gash across his ribs.
"The Prophet explained it to me!"
Aram sounded in a daze, yet his sword moved with liquid ease, blows barely diverted with hammer or belt knife as Perrin backed away. All he could do was hope he did not trip over a tent rope or come up against a tent.
"Your eyes! You're really Shadow Spawn! It was you who brought the Trollocs to the Two Rivers. He explained it all. Those eyes! I should have known the first time I saw you. You and Elias with those Shadow Spawn eyes. I have to rescue the Lady Fail from you!"
Perrin gathered himself. He could not keep moving 10 pounds of steel as quickly as Ara moved a sword that weighed a third of that. Somehow, he had to get close, get beyond that blade blurring with the speed of its motion. He could not do so without getting cut, and likely badly. But if he waited much longer, the man was going to kill him. Something caught his heel, and he staggered backward, nearly falling. Aram darted in, sword chopping down. Suddenly he stiffened, eyes going wide, and the blade dropped from his hands. He toppled forward to lie on his face, two arrows jutting from his back. 30 paces beyond him, a pair of veiled Shido already had arrows knocked and drawn again. Perrin leaped sideways behind a green, peaked tent, rolling to his feet quickly. At the corner of the tent, an arrow was poking through the canvas, still quivering. Crouching, he made his way past the green tent, and then a faded blue one, a low tent of dingy brown, hammer in one hand, knife in the other. This was not the first time he had played this game today. Cautiously, he peeked around the edge of the brown tent. The two Shido were nowhere to be seen. They might be stalking him in turn or off hunting someone else already. The game had turned both ways before. He could see Aram lying where he had fallen. A scrap of breeze ruffled the dark fletchings on the arrow, sticking up from his back. Elias had been right. He should never have let Aram pick up that sword. He should have sent him away with the carts, or made him go back to the Tinkers. So many things he should have done. Too late now.